This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week we'll be talking to Adrian Gropper, MD, about trust in healthcare and lots of other things around that coming up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they are working remotely. Check out lastpass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 605, recorded Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. Trust in healthcare. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Stop letting people keep logs of what you do online and protect your online privacy with one click. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/floss. And by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, and it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles, and I am joined this week by Sean Powers himself. Where are you, Sean? I kind of know.
I'm in Michigan, Northern Michigan, in my office.
You're in Michigan in your office with your ray gun and your other things. So you have been, you're quarantined or your family's quarantined or what's the deal? There's some rumors are going around about your isolation.
What you see behind me has been my home. Within my home for the past 2 weeks, there's a 4-foot love seat that I've been sleeping on every day because due to some frustrating circumstances, my family was exposed to COVID and just about everybody in my house tested positive. I'm still really high risk. So my family did a great job of keeping me in my office separate. There's a bathroom dedicated just for me. And I managed for the entire time when my whole house was full of COVID that I did not get infected. I tested negative. They have all gotten past it. So yesterday was the last person who tested positive, their final day of being infectious. So everybody is out of the woods now. But today starts my 2 weeks of quarantine because I was in a house with COVID positive people. And so after they're no longer contagious, now I have 14 days where I can't go and do anything. But honestly, I don't really do anything anyway. So it's not going to be a big deal.
It looks like something right now. Wow. So you got like a month of in-stir then altogether.
Yeah. The 2 weeks was bad. The 2 weeks was in my office all day and all night. And you'll notice there's no shower in my office. So you can be grateful that Skype doesn't transmit smell.
Unfortunately, this is not smell-o-vision. So our guest this episode is Adrian Gropper, who is an actual MD. We may or may not go at all into pandemic stuff, but have you looked into anything that any preliminaries on what Adrian's all about on this thing?
Yes, I did. So thankfully we get some information that I can, look at ahead of time. And I did, I have questions about privacy and these past 2 weeks, honestly, there's just a plethora of information that people need, different people at different places and contact tracing and all of that stuff. But there's also privacy issues. So I'm really looking forward to today's show to hear more about how that works into what he's doing. So, yeah.
Excellent. So we're actually off to a little bit of a late start. We could go to a late end, too, so we can get a whole hour into this thing. But I want to hurry into letting everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Every day there's another story of how our personal privacy is being invaded, and it's not just social media sites. It's your smart speakers, your smart TV, many other devices. To protect yourself with the same service that I trust and the people here at TwitTrust. And to keep my information safe, I go to ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN encrypts your internet data and hides your IP address so websites, hackers, and even your internet service provider can't track you. It's simple to download the ExpressVPN app onto any of your devices, and it only takes one click to turn it on. That's it. I have it on all day to protect me and my network data. It runs in the background in most cases, also on my phone. It doesn't slow down the connection. That's one of the biggest advantages of it. Wired, CNET, and The Verge rate ExpressVPN the number one VPN on the market. It's less than $7 a month. And if you don't like it for any reason, there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. To me, the biggest thing about ExpressVPN is actually the speed. I've used a number of other VPNs in the past, and nothing touches ExpressVPN for that. So protect your online privacy today with ExpressVPN. You get 3 months of ExpressVPN protection for free when you visit expressvpn.com/floss. That's expressvpn.com/floss for 3 months free with a 1-year package. expressvpn.com/floss to learn more. And thank you to ExpressVPN for sponsoring Floss Weekly. Our guest this week is Adrian Gropper, MD, who is also an engineer and who knows more about healthcare than anybody else I know. And I've worked with him for many years on many projects, and he's involved in even more. So welcome, Adrian, to Floss Weekly.
Thank you, Doc. It's great to be here.
And there you are in an awesome background. So you're in Austin, Texas at the moment, though normally from the Boston area, which yes. is where I met and got to know you. So let's just start with your project, HIE of One. Tell us a little bit about that.
So HIE of One actually goes back about, maybe 30 years to a project at MIT called Guardian Angel. My mentor there, one of them is Pete Solowitz. And this was the first time I learned about agents, technological agents. And it was meant to provide advice to diabetics. This is in the computer science department. So I became intrigued. A number of startups later in the health medical device field, we created HIE of One, which is a modern day version of a person's guardian angel, if you would, as their agent to interact with the medical things, right? Which means physicians, hospitals, devices. And it's been running as a free GPL licensed open source demonstration project. It's not a product at this point in any way, mostly used to inform my work as a privacy and community representative at W3C and other standards groups, Kantara, where I play the sort of role of community advocate for privacy and the patient interest, if you would.
So just so we're clear, HIE stands for Health Information Exchange of One, which, and as a patient, you're one, right? I mean, this is for the patient. And you're also involved in patient privacy rights. And I think your work primarily, and this is what really interests me about it, and how you got involved in Project VRM, which is my project at Harvard's Berkman Center, really starts with the patient and moving outward from the patient rather than starting from the system and moving down toward the patient, which is what most people think they're dealing with when they're getting health care. So maybe you could elaborate a little on the connection between those things.
Yes. Patient Privacy Rights is a nonprofit that I am the volunteer CTO of. It was started by Deborah Peel, whose house I happen to be in right now here in Austin many years ago. And she basically found PPR because as a Freudian analyst, her patients started coming to her as computers were coming on the scene and saying, will you take me as a patient, but only if you do not put my records into a computer? And she got figured out that there was something wrong with what was going on in the digital health record space. And that's what led to PPR. And she's quite well known. So I am kind of the technical counterpart to her advocacy leadership in this patient privacy space. And but my work is primarily engineering. In other words, the difference is that she talks about the problems and I try and figure out the solutions, if possible.
So, I'm imagining the projects that you're working in, including Project VRM, My Data, Cantera, which is another standards development thing, all succeed. And everything you and I and everybody who cares about individual liberty and autonomy and agency, especially, and their agents, but agents that are working for them, not necessarily for the system. These work out. It's 5 years from now. How does the world work? How does the world work now? And look at it from the patient's point of view. I mean, how am I or you as a patient with, say, a problem or just dealing with the healthcare system? What does that look like?
Well, when it comes to information, personal data, think of a dial or a balance between technology that you control as an individual and technology that is controlled by others than you. And right now, individuals control very, very little technology, and we're about to control even less. We control the router that connects things in our home to the internet. Excuse me. What else do we control? We may control the software in our computers to some extent, but that's getting harder and harder all the time. So we don't really control the clients that connect through the router. And with the advent of 5G and things like our devices, telephones, TVs, and everything in between, bypassing the router entirely, there's a risk that we will control no technology. So when you look at it in terms of medicine, in terms of healthcare, and you ask yourself, suppose I needed a brain implant or an implantable cardiac defibrillator on my heart or an artificial pancreas, how much of that piece of technology would I expect to control? How much of it will work if I go to Uganda next week and the vendor network that is here in the United States doesn't have a representative there, for example, or if a company goes out of business? Or what kind of choice will I have in terms of which physician I employ in order to advise me on things that I don't know enough about? In other words, what is the community that supports me as an individual patient or as an individual person if I no longer have a choice of that community, or maybe I can just choose between Verizon and AT&T in my particular location? So, My goal, to get back to your question, is to shift that balance as far as reasonable in the direction of the individual, to give the individual as much control over technology as they are willing to pay for. So, that might be, for instance, $1,000 a year if we believe that, our data, our personal data, the inferences made, whether it's through targeted advertising or dynamic pricing online or whatever, insurance programs that are not necessarily, that don't totally have pre-existing conditions coverage and everything in between, if we believe that our personal circumstances and our personal data might be worth, you know, $5,000 a year to an average American, how much of that would we be willing to pay in order to own, literally own the technology that manages that personal data? And I don't mean, by the way, selling my personal data to the highest bidder and things like that. That is a very, it's like selling your organs to some extent, telling people that their personal data is valuable, and setting up systems to sell it to the highest bidder is not really a solution. So don't interpret what I mean when I say that $1,000. I mean the $1,000 that allows you to control the technology that interacts with you and your personal world.
Okay, so I actually have a question then. And this is going a little bit more towards patient records. And again, it's because it's kind of near and dear to my heart right now with all the COVID stuff that my family has recently gone through. I love the idea of having control over our information, my personal information, my family having their own information. But there's a concern that maybe until the infrastructure is there for the personal control to be able to be doled out wherever we want, that it causes a hindrance to actual healthcare. And my example is, I saw my general practitioner, this isn't about COVID, but a while back, and I had to see another doctor. And I literally had to drive all the way to my doctor, which is a little over an hour drive one way. I had to pick up a folder of papers, and then I had to drive to another town to deliver them because of privacy issues that, in that case, were kind of working against everybody. So the idea of this technology being able to give us control over who has access and stuff is awesome. But in the meantime, is there a transitional sort of framework or plan to make that better than me driving around with a handful of folders?
There has been a series of transitional plans going back maybe 12, 15 years. It started as something called NHIN, the National Health Information Network, again, maybe 15 years ago now, maybe more. The problem with the transitional plan is that none of the stakeholders involved, in other words, not the insurance companies, not the hospitals, not the doctors, not the pharmaceutical companies, none of them really have a major interest in having the transitional plan succeed. We can go into that if you want me to discuss, you know, sort of what the economics of that transitional plan are. But to take you to the future that we are transitioning to, I would say that it has to be, and it will have to be, one where the health records are longitudinal and not just controlled, but obviously travel with the patient. They're associated with the patient. So not just that artificial pancreas or that implantable cardiac defibrillator, but everything lifelong about your medical records should literally be tied to you. Right now, none of it is tied to you. And so which way do you want to take this question of yours, Sean?
Yeah, so... I honestly was just wondering what we can do, right? I hear you talking, and it seems like this this incredible plan, but I'm just curious what we can do on the ground as individual users who care about privacy, but also want things to work and want the doctors to be able to get our data when we deem it for them. What can we do? I guess in the short term, plans have been set out and haven't necessarily worked. So I'm curious more than why things haven't already transitioned or haven't transitioned as smoothly. What can we do to help make that happen?
Well, you can recognize the problem first, because there are very serious efforts underway, particularly there are regulations in place that in effect give you a human right to access and share your health records with anybody that you want, even outside the country, for example. And those regulations are in effect now. They've been around for like a couple of years already. They're literally in effect, though the enforcement part is being delayed partly by COVID until as late as 2023. So there is a parallel universe, in other words, where you, in theory, under your human right of access to medical information, specifically in the U.S., have this right to control records. But the problem in implementing that and making it something that you can do is that nobody really wants to put you in control. They simply want to change from the control by the hospitals, which is this thing that, like I say, has been going on for over 15 years, to control by non-hospital entities like Apple HealthKit, for example, or other equivalent things, because the world is set up to think in terms of platforms, and in particular, proprietary platforms. So even as the regulations give you this human right to literally control your information and direct it, kind of the way you used to in the old days when you talked about paper, you used to be able to go down to the basement and fill out a piece of paper and sign it and say, send these records over there. And over there could be your lawyer, it could be another doctor, and they could charge you some money and they could delay you for up to 30 days, but you had the right to direct access to your records. That right was lost in the digital world. And again, the tendency has always been, just like I mentioned, the start of PPR, to take control away from the individual and actually away from the doctor as well. The doctor doesn't have, you know, if you pick a doctor over there and you say to them, like you did, in your experience, you please look at my records from over here. They don't necessarily have any more power within the HIPAA, within the hospital, within the healthcare system, the old way to get those records than you do to send it to them. Again, I don't want to drone on, hone in on which part of this is not clear.
Well, I need to say first, because we have more questions here, of course, that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology began building its Advanced Technology Center, also called the ATC, 10 years ago, and it has grown exponentially. The lab contains more than $500 million in equipment. It's like no other testing or research lab. WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure their business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation. Hundreds of on-demand and schedulable labs representing the newest advances in multi-cloud architecture, security, networking, primary and secondary storage, data analytics and AI, DevOps, and so much more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proofs of concept and pilots using the sandbox so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. They offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Here, customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. It's virtual, so you can take full advantage of ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world, 24/7. WWT engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment and building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. WWT has launched its new digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. This ecosystem creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for its customers. Get access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. While exploring their new digital platform, make sure to check out the weekly webinar series WWT offers, TEC 37, to hear the latest in technology, education, and collaboration. You can find out more by visiting wwt.com/TEC37. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and to become a member of their growing community, go to wwt.com/twit to create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's wwt.com/twit, WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. So I want to ask a blockchain question, because it's interesting to me that you wrote a paper that won a prize in a blockchain health competition in 2016. That's 4 years ago, meaning this new thing called blockchain is actually getting a little bit elderly at this point, at least in tech time. So I know, you know, there's sort of the difference between fantasy and reality with blockchain, and part of the theme that we want to talk about today is trust. And I think part of the idea behind blockchain is you need to be able to have some system you can trust. So what do you see that being about?
Yes. So, you know, to continue from that last question, you know, do we trade the hospital infrastructure for, you know, sort of the old infrastructure? Do we trade it for a more, a different platform, you know, a platform that, for instance, is run by, you know, whoever, Amazon or Apple? So blockchain technology represents not just an obvious example of self-sovereign technology, probably the most successful example of a non-platform of a self-sovereign technology in the marketplace. You know, I'm not sure if it's the largest example of free software around, but economically speaking, but it's probably it's by far the largest, the fastest uptake of a free software self-sovereign technology. And when you know, from hanging around the MIT Bitcoin Club, actually an undergraduate club of that's really quite effective, quite interesting. When I learned about blockchain, you know, whatever it was, 5-6 years ago, I realized that it was the solution to many, many years of work, of my work in these standards for identity management, you know, which were up till then based on federated technology, you know, governance and relationships amongst peers. These peers not being us as individuals or even us as individual doctors. And I knew very well at that point the limits of federation as a structural, as a foundation for managing personal data. And I realized instantly, as I saw how people were interacting as a community, as a developer community, as a deployment community with blockchains, with the public blockchains, not the private blockchains, you know, with Bitcoin and Ethereum by then, that this was a completely different path, a completely different solution from OpenID Connect and SAML and other, you know, other technologies, including OAuth, that depend on federated agreements, and again, do not serve that do not try to redress that asymmetry of power that we want to get back to with our agents.
So, blockchain. So, I've been working with blockchain for a long time too, and I So one of the things I noticed in the paper, I read one of the papers that you had sent us about what you were doing, and the idea of having self-sovereign control of data, health data. One of the bullet points was talking about the user has full control, but also full responsibility. And I'm not quoting properly, but I instantly was concerned if let's say there is somebody who for some reason loses the ability to access their data. Let's say they're a forgetful co-host or they've been in an accident or something like that. The idea of a blockchain with the sole person being in control is a little unsettling, only because, I mean, what if I were to lose all of my data? And then before, and the answer to that is probably like having multiple people with access or, you know, that you deem as responsible for that. So you can answer that. But the other question I have is, how does this go into not just patient records, but early on you talked about things like implants. Like, I'll be honest, I talked with Kyle Rankin, who a friend of ours, he's been on the show, I think, before, about brain implants, right? I really want to have an implant so that I can communicate with my cell phone quicker than my big fat thumbs. However, having an implant in my brain, I know the technology's not there yet, but that's a scary endeavor. One, who has access to that? I don't want ads to be popping up in my vision, literally, while I'm driving. And I don't want people to have access to my inner thoughts or, you know, depending on the integration factor of the hypothetical brain implant that I'm talking about. That privacy is something that is going to be even more freaky, right? I mean, it's going to be so much more important when it starts to involve hardware in our bodies that, you know, interacts and has a network. So is that, are you hoping that all of the things come together in some sort of individually managed privacy perfect world?
Well, yes. First of all, since you mentioned the brain implant to talk to your phone, I have to urge you to definitely look up The President's Analyst. It's a movie from the 70s that you will enjoy. About exactly that. The thing that we discovered as we started applying this blockchain philosophy, let me call it, to the problem you're saying is that there had to be two layers of self-sovereign technology. That technology, which is entirely self-sovereign to you, and yes, it's like a Bitcoin wallet, you know, you're going to choose, you're going to have a choice at that level as to whether the recovery is managed by a custodian, you know, like an exchange, for instance, that happens to offer recovery services, or whether recovery is going to be managed by your friends and family, you know, in a multi-signature sense, in a threshold sense. That's not any different for health records than it would be for any other asset. The second layer that we discovered needed to be introduced is the self-sovereign community, meaning that just like the technology you're using to control or to have, yes, to have control over that brain implant is self-sovereign, and that, of course, includes free open source, the configuration of that technology, in other words, what it's initialized with before it's implanted in you, and how it's supported, and how it connects to the doctors, for instance, that it might need to reprogram it because you don't know how to reprogram it. You know, how do they find you, or how do you find them? There has to be a community of users that you trust and that you choose in order to make that practical. And so, you know, the HIE of One project itself is called Trustee. That's the agent. And we literally had to invent this thing that is also self-sovereign that we call Trustee Community, which is chosen by the individual. And the individual can belong to multiple communities, though that means that the agent is obviously gets to be more sophisticated because it has to reconcile policies that are inherited from multiple communities. The agent and you always retain the right to change the policies in however fine-grained a way you want, but you inherently have to have this right of choosing the community that you want to associate with and it being self-sovereign as well.
So I have a question about because we have a worldwide audience here. And it's very easy for me, especially, you know, because I have health and try to care for it. And I'm in the U.S., which is absurd in many ways, versus the rest of the world. I mean, somebody we both know, for example, had hip repair surgery in Germany, and it cost like 9,000 euros. And that was it. And had a hip replacement in the U.S., and it was close to $500,000. And where in the hospital, when the bill came in, that goes to Medicare, for a COVID test was $750. Just among the list of things you're done was this thing, which means that, you know, I mean, that, there's no way that could be justified economically, I don't think, except to just enrich the insurance companies, I guess. I don't know. But I'm wondering whether or not, as we try to develop communities around trying to solve some of these problems, even in the U.S., it's better to try and join an effort that's either worldwide or outside the U.S. or ignores the craziness that's in the U.S. I mean, I'm wondering how we do that, because you and I are both, all three of us are physically in the U.S., but we're dealing with communities, you know, like my data, for example, all of the communities we're involved with are worldwide. And that healthcare is one of those areas where it's different everywhere. I mean, it's, I mean, for the most part, elsewhere in the world, healthcare is a right and not a privilege. But in the U.S., it's a privilege that you get through an employer. But more and more of us are self-employed now. Number one employer here in Santa Barbara is self. How do you deal with that? I mean, and if you're trying to do the solution side of this, which is what we're doing with in the floss world, where do you go? You know, do we try to stay home with this or go elsewhere? Sorry. Go ahead.
I think the short answer is you already said it. You want to introduce medical tourism, which becomes particularly easier, of course, as the technology gets better and as even in this country, the pandemic drives more and more care to be delivered through telemedicine. And so the short answer is use medical tourism every time, every chance you get. Not only are you saving money, but you're sending a message to the system that will cause it to reform for the benefit of everyone. To take that to the second level, it's kind of, you have to do that to globalize, you know, health and the right to healthcare at three levels, unfortunately. There is certainly the technology part. There is also the regulatory part. And the regulatory part, by technology, I mean communications technology or health records technology and the standards that, you know, that I work on that include, of course, digital identity as well as authorization and all of that. And none of those are healthcare specific, right? So to get to your question, Doc, these three layers are basically the following. Number one are the things about medical tourism that have nothing to do with healthcare. They're not healthcare specific. And those are basically identity and authorization and communications technology and audit of those critical elements. Something that we are now starting to think about in the tech world as zero trust architecture. And zero trust architecture, in effect, is kind of the evolution, like I talked about, evolving away from federated identity to self-sovereign identity. You could think of zero trust architecture as being sort of the corporate mainstream of realizing that same future. The second thing that you have to deal with is the regulatory aspect for physicians. You know, will your physician work locally, or your nurse for that matter, or any fiduciary, any licensed professional work with you if you're doing medical tourism for part of your care, whether you're just doing it through telemedicine or literally by traveling to Germany to get your hip replaced, which was a famous I forget, magazine article by somebody like 5-6 years ago that literally wrote up this thing as a series of pieces. I think it was Belgium that they went to get their hip replacement in or their knee. In any case, and then the third layer is the device management layer or the pharmaceutical management layer. In other words, we all know about, and it's still unsettled as to whether you'll be able to import drugs from Canada, for example, and the very active debate. And that certainly applies not just to drugs, but it applies to that brain implant that Sean wants and so on. So, yeah, let me stop there. But in principle, you're absolutely right. Self-sovereign people are not restricted to the federation that happens to be associated with the, in this country, the state that they happen to be in.
So I had to write this down, medical tourism. I know people who have gone to Costa Rica or Brazil to have dental surgery or to get, their eyeballs switched or some other thing like that. I mean, just because it's cheaper and they can get a vacation at the same time. And if they've had their face repaired, they look ugly somewhere else for a while.
And by the way, there are insurance plans that will actually pay you to do that.
Really?
Not only will they cover the expense, but they'll pay you $1,000 for your troubles.
I didn't know that. That's what are those called?
I don't know. They don't have a specific name.
We'll have to look that up. You have these three layers: ID authorization, the caregiver, and where that happens, device management, and Sean's brain implant. The first of those, ID, you and I have both been involved in that. Just in the last few days, it has come up that both Apple and Google want to do ID 1.0 over again, where they're the identity provider. Would Microsoft tried and failed to do with Passport 100 years ago, and Hailstorm, if anybody remembers that initiative, which is sort of the encompassing one, which is basically to smush the entire world into their identity management system, and that's where you would live, because already you've got an IMEI number on your phone, you can associate that with it, you go everywhere, you're on a tether, and it's going to be like login with Facebook or login with Google. I very much do not want this. We're not going to get away from that entirely, but I really want to be fully in charge of how I'm identified in what Kim Cameron, in his Laws of Identity in 2004 called minimum disclosure for constrained use, justifiable parties, plurality of operators. But that the big one there is really, individual control, autonomy, and minimum disclosure for constrained uses. And SSI, self-sovereign identity, is very much involved in this. But I worry about the difference between identity and identifiers, especially when it comes to medicine somehow. I want to be able to identify myself as, what do you need to know? I have these preconditions. Here's how you're known to me, and that's it. You don't need to know more than that. So where do we stand on that right now, if anywhere?
Well, it's very complicated. The one thing that is pretty clear is that every country, every rich country, at least around the world, and not, I would say every country right now at the government level, is looking at digital identity now in various forms. And, some of them are doing very forward looking things, like here in the U.S., the Department of Homeland Security was the major funder for self-sovereign identity work over the last 5 years. Canada has done it at the province level into self-sovereign identity. But you have tenders out from, say, Scotland, Singapore, places around the world. Certainly Europe as a whole is trying to deal with this post EIDAS and figuring out. So, number one, there is huge government interest in looking at digital identity from the government services side, not necessarily, by the way, from the how do these government services identities necessarily work with your commercial healthcare banking and other private sector activities. Though obviously they realize that this is a problem. There is no broad consensus as to how to solve this crossover between government service identity, how you pay your taxes, how you get welfare, how you get a travel document, how you get a business license, et cetera, versus your identity in the non-government sector. The other thing that has happened, of course, is we've had early digital identity efforts that have already been around for 5+ years, Estonia and India being examples of where digital identity was adopted at a national scale, by mandate, and reasonably successfully. I mean, Estonia had a breach that cost them some money a few years ago. India still has major sort of privacy and security questions, but given that they rolled this out to 1.1 plus billion people, but people are not rushing these other countries that I mentioned, and in general are not rushing to develop a centralized biometric digital identity on the model of Aadhaar in India for many good reasons. So I'm not sure how far away from your question I got, but at least you're right. The framing is that this activity is happening right now at the government level. So now then what we have is we have the traditional data brokers with respect to identity, and that includes Verizon and AT&T, who had very good ways of knowing who everybody is. And we're given responsibility, I'm told, I don't know firsthand, for figuring out, how you control the nuclear codes in a country and stuff like that. In the private sector, then we now have outfits like Facebook and Twitter and Apple and Google that are, in effect, a new generation of data brokers, different from the telecoms. And they, too, have so much surveillance in place but it's not at all clear that government and even private entities, unless the regulatory system changes drastically from the regulatory system we have now around the world, that they will accept an Apple, Amazon, Google solution to digital identity. So we are very much at an interesting time because self-sovereign identity is relatively new and definitely untested in any meaningful way. But at least, the U.S. and a few other countries, not including Europe to a large extent, basically went and put their foot down and said, we are going to develop standards for digital identity before we decide on what the platforms look like or what the services look like. And that is a radical departure from what happened in India, what happened in Estonia, what's happening in Europe today. So on the other hand, in Europe, we have a lot more privacy focus as well as economic jealousy of Silicon Valley and, that kind of dominance of the platforms. And that is also unsettled. So it's an interesting time relative to your question, Doc.
So I'm going to be a Debbie Downer here. I see that Apple, Google, they have money, right? I mean, they have so much money that they, and technology that they could provide a system that works really well, but benefits them more than any individual.
That's right.
And I think the only way that they would be inclined to make it a more individual mandate, privacy controlled by the individual sovereign identity type situation is with government regulation, unfortunately. But I mean, this past year has shown us that most of our Congress people don't know how to work a Zoom meeting, right? So I don't know that we have lobbyists who know what they're doing, but they're, again, paid for by companies. So I worry that while it's an interesting time, I have kind of bleak outlooks on this because boy, money talks. And, you know, the government is supposed to be who protects us from companies doing things like this. But I'm just not sure the government is up to speed on what they should be regulating, how they should be regulating it. And I won't even mention politics because holy cow.
Yes. So absolutely. And, you know, I am also involved in participating in the Uniform Law Commission, for instance, where they're trying to figure out how to deal with the equivalent of California CCPA across the country if the federal government doesn't pass regulations at the federal level, privacy regulations. Yeah, but this is what I tried to say, and let me repeat it if I wasn't clear. This is why around the world, governments are saying, we're going to solve this identity, this single sign-on and, you know, deduplication problem within the government services sector. And we are purposely going to ignore the private sector when we do this, because within the government sector, they can impose much stronger privacy and much stronger regulatory constraints than they could get through whatever Congress they have in that particular jurisdiction. That's what we're seeing right now. That's why I said there was a disconnect between what might happen in the public sector and what seems to be happening in the private sector.
So we're getting down to the end of the show here, and this has been great. I'm glad we've been able to get most of an hour out of this, because there's an infinitude more stuff that we could go into. So I want to just ask one final actual question before we get to sort of our pro forma ones at the very end, which is there any question we haven't asked that you'd like us to have asked, and you could answer fairly briefly?
Well, you didn't ask anything about what we're learning as a result of the COVID, of the pandemic, which has shown around the world two huge problems. One of them is the lack of resilience in healthcare systems, particularly in the United States, but in many other countries as well. And also around the world, the absence of a calculus of trust or a solution to the trust problem. You know, we call it misinformation, we call it whatever you want, but we didn't get into either of, we didn't get into the fact that we are in the midst of this really unique event, which hopefully stays unique, but nobody really believes that it will. And it has, you know, it's like turning on the light in a dark room and seeing the cockroaches scurry around.
Well, I'm kind of sorry we didn't open up with that, because that obviously that's just a prevailing condition, especially with Sean in his COVID house retreat there. I mean, it's close to home. I mean, somebody asked me, well, do you know anybody who's had COVID? And I thought, I know plenty of people who've had COVID, and I know people like Sean who just had family members that are involved in this. And you're right. I mean, it's not just cockroaches. It's like many different species are scurrying into the corners, and it's kind of like we don't have a controlled test on every possible approach to this, but we certainly have a lot of different approaches to compare when it's over and learn from. But anyway, so we'll have to have you back and talk about that and wherever we are at that point, because I think it's going to be really important. And I can't think of any voice I'd rather have on the show talking about. So we have a couple of final questions that we tend to ask. One we've already covered, which is blockchain. But the
you
other,
can't have a meeting but, about a blockchain question.
You know, that's sort of our control question. We'll just ask something about blockchain and see how everybody takes it differently. But well, I knew you were already on that case already, and the fact that you won that award 4 years ago is interesting to me. It's like, has it been that long? They're pretty funny. But the last two are, what are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
BBEdit tends to be used to be, but I don't code these days. I haven't coded in 20 years. I really shouldn't be answering that question.
So it's not Emacs versus BI. You know, BBEdit is good on the Mac as an aftermarket thing.
They stopped doing Text Wrangler, which bummed me out. Now you just have to use BBEdit in its unactivated form if you want the free one. So,
yeah. Yes, exactly what's happening to me. You're right.
Yeah, and we'll see where it goes with scripting languages. It's interesting that just as a piece of news that Guido Van Rossum is now at Microsoft. You know, he was retired and he kind of unretired to go to Microsoft, which is now like maybe the biggest open source operator on Earth in a certain kind of way. So that's the subject.
And we did talk about platforms a bit. Microsoft is the wild card in the platform environment.
It is. There's
a huge amount of effort in the standards world. They're not seen as a platform in the same way that Apple and Google were, certainly in mobile. And they're trying to make a next generation play. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about there. So, Adrian, thanks so much for being on the show. This has been fantastic. I'm glad we got the tech to work. I love your background there. Compliment Deborah Peel for that. She's great. She's got a great house. And we'll see you next time.
Okay, thanks. It was great.
So, Sean, that was good. How to play for you?
Yeah, I have to be honest. Now I'm ready to start. I have all sorts of questions now.
I know.
It is a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and my Debbie Downerism is true, right? I'm super bummed that I think the big tech companies have the money and the ability to make it so easy, but their motivation will not be to do it right. Their motivation will be self-serving because that's how big companies get big. And I don't know. It's frustrating.
Yeah. It's, it is probably the biggest topic in the world. I mean, healthcare in general, and probably trust is as well. Identity certainly is. I've been involved in that one since the 90s. I've been involved in all this crap since the 90s, and it's just like, wow, you know. But what I love about Adrian is that he is absolutely peripatetic on this and a very hard worker and trying to do the right thing at all times. So I advise people to follow his work. I think he's possibly the most important figure in the healthcare field, especially for the open source and standards and community side of it. He's not a one-man band. He's involved in a lot of different projects. So check him out.
And I didn't ask, but are there governmental ties there? I mean, is there hope that somebody's whispering in the right ear?
There's policy questions we didn't ask. Yeah, I know. There's a lot we didn't ask. So anyway, so what have you got to plug? Because we're past the normal end of everything, and we always have plugs at the end of the show.
I've been on hiatus living in my office for 2 weeks, so there's really nothing that I've done new apart from showering. Just my lower third, I think, says my stuff, YouTube channel, Twitter feed. You'll find me there.
Yeah, and so I also want to plug next week, which we're going to have Vinay Gupta on. I know Vinay Gupta from my time in the UK, and he's been involved in doing good work around the world with his Hexayurt project, and now he's involved in COVID, and he's got a thing called Influminati, which is a discussion group around that. So we'll have him back next week. So thanks, Adrian. Thanks, Sean. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll see you next week on the next Floss Weekly.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and we talk about everything that has to do with Android. Is it news? Is it hardware? Is it apps? Well, you name it, we talk about it. We invite guests from the industry on the show. We even sometimes have people from the Android team themselves talking about what makes Android so great. And you could subscribe so you don't miss anything about the world of Android by going to twit.tv/AAA. We'll see you there.